So I'm going to attempt spending the next hour or so talking about one concept, and that is the concept of faith and the pivotal role that it takes within the practice, how important this quality of faith is and can be, and how much, for probably a variety of reasons, it doesn't always get mentioned so much in the Dharma space, for maybe obvious reasons. So before I get into that a little bit, I just kind of ask you to just kind of reflect as you sit there and just some of the initial reactions that some of us have when we hear this word faith. Maybe some suspicion, some distrust, maybe some thinking of like, oh, I think I can do without that. But it certainly plays a pivotal role in the practice of the Dharma, and I'm going to really try to see if I can unpack that and speak to it in a variety of ways so that maybe it feels more accessible. I think by and large, the word or the concept of faith has really, for the last hundreds of years, really been hijacked by religion, as I'm sure you know. And I think it's time we take the word back. I think it's a beautiful word. I think it means a lot. I think it's very powerful. And it's something that I think we can find in our own way that we can kind of work with. It's been very important to me. And so when we say that, so this Pali word, so there is a word for it in the Buddhist tradition called sada, faith. And it really doesn't actually, the English translation for faith doesn't quite do the heavy lifting in terms of trying to understand how comprehensive this concept is. And as a teacher, one of the things that I do, and maybe you get tired of it, is addressing these Pali words. And the reason I do that is because a lot of the concepts that we're exploring in the practice are very, very meaningful. And understanding the way that these words kind of are translated into modernity is very important. And one of the habits that we get as teachers that I'm trying to overcome is this idea of trying to find the singular English word that acts as a translation for the Pali word. And that's almost never possible because these Pali words, they're very, very dynamic and they mean a lot more than something like faith. And so it can mean faith. It also can mean trust. Maybe that word's even worse for you than faith. a kind of trusting, or really a confidence, which is probably the word that has the least charge for most of us. A kind of self-confidence, the ability to do something. And if we think about it in those terms, it's not so maybe upsetting or suspicious, because anything you've ever done in your life, whether you've gotten to school or gotten a degree or gotten everything you've ever done in your life that you've ever accomplished, you were only able to do so because you thought you could. So there's just a lot of utility in this idea of having a kind of can-do attitude. So we can think about it as faith, we can think about it as confidence, we can think about it as trust. There's actually a couple other words, pasada, which means trust, that's another word in the Buddhist lexicon. This other word that we haven't spoken about a lot in this retreat, but it's very rich in really all the Buddhist traditions, which is this idea of taking refuge. Many of you are familiar with this, this Pali word saranam, to take refuge. And I think there's a very strong correlation between the word faith, sada, and this taking refuge. And there's maybe even a more beautiful dimension to the concept of refuge than perhaps of faith. And they also share similar definitions as well. And that's not always outlined or identified by the tradition, which I find to be a bit odd. So refuge, when we take refuge, refuge is basically kind of translated as to place the heart upon. So what we want to try to do in the Buddhist system is learning how can I place my heart upon something that's actually trustworthy. And another way to say that in even a more simple sense is whatever I'm paying attention to some degree I'm trusting in the present moment. How much of your time, how much of your life do you spend paying attention to things that are insanely untrustworthy? Right? in some ways, we're putting our heart onto these things, right? We're taking refuge in the phone, in the media, and, you know, all kinds of different things. And so attention, that's why we talk so much about attention in the cognitive dimension, because whatever we pay attention to has tremendous consequence. And so maybe we should be a little bit more involved and a little bit more tuned into how that works. Now, also in the Abhidharma, the teachings on Buddhist psychology, the Pali word sada, it's characterized specifically, like right out of the manual, the characteristic is to place one's heart upon, to pay attention to release the mind onto an object. That's really the mechanics of that. And you've been doing it all week. Have you know, you release your mind onto the object of the natural world. Pretty trustworthy. Anybody been burned by watching the river this week? Probably not so much. Right? Because you've placed your heart upon that. You turned your attention. You release your mind onto that object, onto all of these objects. And then we learn over time what objects to release the mind onto. So in many ways, the mechanics of this is actually not really so complicated. It's really quite simple. And this is, I think, very interesting, and maybe the most important thing I'll say, is that the concept of faith in a Buddhist context is what it does. It does have a function, and its function is to clarify and stabilize the mind. That's what faith does, which doesn't sound religious at all to me, does it? And so think about it. I want my mind to be stable. I want my mind to be clear. That's what faith does psychologically. It stabilizes and clarifies the mind. And also, too, when we have decisions and we have difficult circumstances in our life where we maybe have to make choices, when I feel clear and I feel stable about what that choice is, it's very easy to do it because there's an element of confidence. There's an element of trust. So in Buddhist psychology, it's really just kind of a mental state. And again, it's not something that you either have or don't have. Like, you just can't have faith in the Dharma all the time. I mean, if you are able to do that, please let me know how you pulled that one off. So again, it's not either I have it or I don't. Sometimes I do. Sometimes that I don't. And sometimes maybe it's somewhere in that middle. But when we notice as an indriya, the other way it's described in another set of lists, which is called the five spiritual faculties, which the translation is indriya, an indriya. And an indriya is something that does something. Like the eyes are indriyas. The eyes see objects. The ears hear sound. The faith indriya clarifies and stabilizes the mind. That's what it does. That's its support faculty. So the word and the concept of faith does show up in some pretty important places. And the way that it manifests is that it manifests as a stabilized mind, as a clear and stabilized mind. And it manifests as a sense of resolve and resolution, conviction almost, clarity. Do this, don't do that. You know what I mean? It's very, very almost surgical in a way. It's not confused at all. Very, very clear, has a lot of energy behind it. And then, of course, what comes with that is all these other things that arise that support the mind, things like courage and mindfulness. They're all supported by the faith. Faith is really the most fundamental element. So what, as you kind of maybe hear some of this, I always encourage people, whatever you need to do to come to terms with this word is certainly worth it. And trying to find maybe words and ideas so that way we can get a sense into it. Another way to speak about it in psychological terms that I think is kind of important to name is that when we think about faith, when we think about actually many words, there's really two dimensions to language. There's the cognitive dimension, which is kind of what the word means and the logic and the reason. And then there's the affective dimension, which is actually much more subtle. It's how that is effective. It's affecting us. And another way to say that is really the vedana, the feeling. And so in many ways, faith is a pleasant, unworldly feeling. Right? And it doesn't have a lot. It's hard to detect. It's not a lot of valence to it. It's like, do I feel it? Sometimes you actually probably do. Right? And when we think about faith in the cultural sense, especially in the religious sense, for example, it largely occupies the cognitive domain, almost to the point where the affective is like not even outlined or even recognized as being important. It's really about dogma. Faith is about dogma. Faith is generally about believing in something. It's usually associated with belief. And that's usually where it rests. It rests in that part of the mind, which is actually not so helpful. Because I don't know about you, I've been, you know, introduced to lots of things I was supposed to believe in over the years and over my lifetime, and I've had very little luck with it, mostly because I'm very suspicious of that whole thing, which is why I wanted to start off the talk with like just noticing your reaction and your response to the word. And largely a lot of it is because of the way the word has been addressed or the way that we've come into contact with it. And so in the Buddhist context, there is the Dharma. The Sada faith experience is largely an affective experience. It's really an inner resource. It's something that we can rely on. It's something that we can pull from. It's something that we can utilize. It's also something that we can cultivate. You know, it has that ability that we can cultivate it, and we can see that actually in many ways it is a very valuable resource. And so another way to maybe try to get us to be a little bit more excited about the word is, it's sometimes hard to do, but it can be valuable to reflect on actually what would it mean, what does it mean to live without faith? What is the consequence of having no faith? We can slide into what Mahasi Sayadaw and Thomas Merton talk about as the dark night of the soul, where there's this tremendous sense of despair and anguish and meaninglessness and fear and pain of fear and suffering. And I know a lot of you are probably all familiar with that. And a lot of that is really the result of not having anything that we can take refuge in, not having anything that we can trust. So when we start to reflect on that and maybe look at our lives and our experiences in times when we were living without faith, the concept becomes a little bit more attractive because the consequence is so strong. There's a, during the pandemic, at the beginning of the pandemic, I got turned onto a book by a modern philosopher. And I always think that philosophers were like, in the olden times, you know. But there are modern philosophers. There are people who, like, still study philosophy. And there's a great philosopher named Martin Haglund who wrote a book that was very, very striking and very helpful to me called This Life. And the tagline was Secular Faith and Spiritual Freedom. And it's actually a philosophical book on utilizing faith in the secular dimension and this life, that this is really the life that we have as far as we know, and how can we come to terms with trying to find faith or trying to find confidence, or really what he would say, trying to find meaning in a finite and tragic world. And he mentions this thing that's very poignant. He says, for all of us, faith becomes truly essential when we wake up to the fact that we're staring eyeball to eyeball with a cold and uncaring, meaningless universe.
Damn.
You might have been there. You know, in moments like that, all of a sudden you're like, yeah, maybe a little faith be kind of nice right about now. Right? And that's his position, is that you know, like there is, this is really an inside job. And a lot of the reason why religion has maybe survived is because it offers us consolation for what it's like to stare into that cold, uncaring, meaningless universe. It's like, don't worry about that. Just believe in all these things over here, and when you die, you'll be taken care of, and you don't have to worry about it. Religion kind of has it all worked out for you. In many ways, it's consolation, right? And I have no, you know, criticism of that. I understand why that might be attractive. It has not been attractive to me. And so I've had to really struggle and to kind of work with these things in a way of trying to come to terms with what does it mean? How can we actually use the Dharma in a way that can fill this emptiness, this experience? And can we? And do we even want to? I am telling the story. I oftentimes end up telling the story of how I got introduced to the Dharma because it was so important. And I usually will say that, you know, it was the practice of mindfulness and this awareness of this other way of being that actually was what really, really helped me. And that's a little bit true. And then even the other day I kind of spoke about it. I was like, well, yeah, it was that. But also it was this relief that I got from this idea that maybe, not definitely, maybe I was okay, or maybe I was going to be okay. That kind of metta. But I think actually what was underneath both of those things, and it took me maybe a long time, maybe I only figured it out recently, that really what was underneath that actually was this faith experience. That I had the effective sense of like, there was a trusting going on. I didn't know that was what was going on. I couldn't tell you what I was trusting in, but there was that sense of something being just held by something that was bigger than me, and that I didn't have to do it all, that I could actually be held by something. And, you know, mindfulness helps with that. Maybe some metta helps with that. But I think the reason why this is so pointed out in the tradition is what the Buddha is saying is actually what's sitting at the bottom of all this is this, like there's something that I can rest on. There's something I can put my attention on. There's some place I can put my heart. That's trustworthy is the word that I would use, trustworthy. And trustworthiness is a very difficult thing to find. But we can find it. And I would argue that many of you have already been seeing or doing much of this since you've been here, but maybe you haven't seen it necessarily in this kind of frame. And so really trying to come to terms with that, like take this idea of taking refuge of like, okay, like, you know, and a lot of times it's really about ourselves, you know. We can trust into our own experience. One of my, can you guys still hear me good? Yeah, good. One of my dear friends who was actually a big part of mindfulness coming to America and big part of the early Dharma institutions coming up, who's actually not as well known as she should be, his name is Mirabai Bush, and she lived near me in Massachusetts. And she talks about faith as a radical confidence that arises from looking directly into the mind. I love that. A radical confidence that arises from looking directly into the mind. And seeing that there's this massive shift that we have. And there's a way in which we can be stable. We can be just sitting here. We can just kind of have this experience of being okay. And so when we start to see these experiences, like I noticed for me when the emotional fear is really present in my mind, economic security, the security of the world, you know, the world is kind of a little bit of a scary place at the moment. And so this is very real. I take this very seriously. And so it can be very easy to be hijacked by a kind of fear, a fear of uncertainty, a fear of pain, an unknowing. And then we can kind of really, the mind can really start to imagine and to really cook up all kinds of circumstances where we do find ourselves in anguish and despair and that meaninglessness kind of experience. And if we don't have something to balance that out with ourselves, I don't know about you, but I can fall down there pretty quickly. I do have one personal policy that I try to stick to that I don't always do, but I do have a policy with myself that I'm not allowed to go to the dark side. You know, like I always think of the movie Star Wars, like never underestimate the force of the dark side, the power of the dark side. I'm like, yeah, never underestimate the power of the dark side. You know, in my mind, you know, because I live there for so long, I have so much familiarity with that. It's really easy to go there. And sometimes I almost find it weirdly comforting. I used to do this thing, and I'm just remembering now, that really points to this. And how we can actually sometimes take a kind of misguided and destructive kind of refuge in things like the dark side. When I was 11, my older sister was killed in a car accident. She was 15 on the way to school. And, you know, at the time, and often the case is families don't really know how to handle these kinds of things. So, you know, it was this huge tragic loss. It was terrible for my family. It was just terrible. It was like in the newspaper of our town. It was like this huge event. And then it was like a couple, not too soon after that, I was back in school on Monday, you know, in math class, being like, what the fuck? Like, why is everybody acting normal? Why, you know, this really kind of traumatic dimension of what I would really kind of say very dark side like. And my parents were so traumatized, and it was so hard for them, probably harder for them than it was for me at the time. They didn't clean my sister's bedroom out for like a couple of years, which I'm told is pretty unhealthy. And so when no one was around, I used to sneak into her room, and I would, she had all these great like tapes. She had like, you know, Black Sabbath and AC/DC, all these like really heavy metal tapes. And they were on a shoebox under her bed, and I would go into her bedroom, and she had one of those boom boxes with those big 70s like style headphones that I still have because I love them. And I would just sit in her room, and I would listen to heavy metal music for hours. And it was like, it felt so scary and terrible and bad and wrong, but it felt so good at the same time. And then I would, eventually they would, my parents would find me in there, and I would like get in like a lot of trouble. I was like really not supposed to go in there. And I used to do it all the time. And then I'd like, every once in a while, I'd like take one of the tapes out till there were just no more tapes left. And this kind of what introduced me to like, you know, in the 80s, heavy metal music and like Metallica and like all that, like really dark, heavy, despairing music was like, actually for me, was a great refuge for quite some time. It was all I had, you know, it was all I had until drugs and alcohol entered the equation, thankfully, at the time. And so, you know, as human beings, when we go through these really challenging experiences, we actually don't realize it, but we really seek to find faith in just about anything. You know, we do have this kind of really deep desire and appetite for finding places where we can dwell or where we can be, that we feel somewhat secure and somewhat stable. And those are not always good things, you know? We had a meeting about that earlier. Like, this is really kind of what addiction is. You know, we take refuge in the destructive forces of the mind and of the behaviors. Right? And that is a big consequence of not having some kind of wholesome or some kind of faith, some place to dwell in ourselves where we can kind of feel good about. You will seek it out. And so I want to talk a little bit about the journey of faith and its relationship to the journey of wisdom. Some of you, probably many of you, are familiar with Sharon Salzberg, who has been the ultimate advocate of the practice of metta since day one. So I bow down to Sharon. She's been uncompromising about that. And she's really been, you know, for 50 years now, been advocating the importance and the power of this practice. And she's a little bit been kind of a lone wolf in that capacity. But she also has another book called Faith, which I think is her best book. It's probably her least known book, least popular book. And she really, really talks about this in a really, really great way because she kind of talks about her story with it and her struggle with it. And also it said that faith is the beginning of all good things. Or we would even say faith is the beginning of all beautiful things. And it's really, for many people, the kind of beginning of turning a lot of these things around. And one thing to just kind of remember is that certainly without a doubt, faith really appears at the onset and the beginning of the path. And because it appears at the onset and at the beginning of the path does not mean or imply that it should be ever put aside. And it said it should never be put aside because it should be cultivated because it's inherently precious. And so it's something that we, you know, you take with you from, it's really in the entire Buddhist endeavor, it's in the teachings top to bottom. And it ultimately, its manifestation is it manifests as wisdom, as a deep understanding. And so she talks about three kinds of faith that are really part of our journey that we go through. and really kind of part of our narrative to some degree. And one thing that's really helpful, some of you have been doing this for a little while, some of you have been doing this for a long time, and this is why it's so great to have Dharma friends and being able to talk about the practice with people, because kind of having a coherent narrative and an understanding about your Dharma journey is actually really, really valuable. Understanding, you know, we really can get a sense of the progress that we made. Of like, yeah, like, this is where I started. And this is where I am now. And seeing that over time, we actually do recover. We do so well. And one of the things that's always inspiring to me, we had, a recovery meeting early today. And it's like, I think that we forget so much the ultimate story of that. It's having been somebody who's worked in prisons and treatment centers and lots of places where there's lots of suffering, one of the pros and cons of that, what makes that so hard is the stories that I've heard of people that I know, the things that people go through in this world, trauma and abuse and loss, the stuff that happens to us is just, it's gut-wrenching. It's horrible. But yet, people really come out the other side. And some of you have been through that experience. Like, we really do. Like, we really can overcome everything. You know, the things that people go through. And we all love the story of redemption, right? And I actually think that, in many ways, the Buddhist Dharma of awakening is not a story of liberation and salvation, actually. And oftentimes, that's how it's taught. It's like, oh, I'm going to be liberated. It's like, well, I just want to be okay. Like, I'll take liberation if it comes. Or this idea, and this is where the religion kind of stuff can be kind of butt heads with the Dharma, is, you know, this idea of salvation, which is a very religion, very Judeo-Christian idea, which is actually kind of disempowering, because what's rooted in the idea of salvation is something needs to save me. I don't want to be saved. You know, I'm not, that's a scary proposition. I want to recover. I want to do the work. I want to do the heavy lifting myself. And that's really where like, if you put all the world's religions on the stage, Buddhism stands out like a sore thumb, because what's being offered in this practice is actually generally diametrically opposed to what everything else is being said. This isn't about salvation. This is about redemption. You know, this is about overcoming the great struggles of this world, of this life, and the fact that we go through very, very difficult things, we go through really hard things, and we do well. I know so many people who are living happy lives, doing very, very well, and at one time, man, they were not, myself included. You know, and that is a result of really opening to this kind of bright faith of the practice. And the reason why it's good or beautiful in the beginning, in the middle, in the end, and I think the reason why this teaching is so powerful is a lot of times, and you might be in that category right now, sometimes we come into contact with the Dharma after having gone through lots of struggles and maybe have tried many different things and found it to be wanting or found it to be unsuccessful. And there can be that feeling of, oh, gee, I wish I knew about this earlier. You know, I wish I'd have gotten the Dharma. You know, a lot of people struggle with that. And this teaching really kind of slices right through that, because there is this timeless dimension to the practice. It's like, yeah, but right now, it's good, you know? And that's what Sharon calls this bright faith. You know, it's kind of the most beautiful one of the three. It's that, you know, it's that meeting somebody who introduces you to the practice. It doesn't have to be epic. It can be a book that you read, maybe one of the first books you read on Buddhism or the Dharma that started to make sense to you. It could be a podcast or an interview or something that you saw. It could be taking an 8-week MBSR class, as it is for a lot of people. You know, and for a lot of people, why I'm so happy for all of you is that it really, really comes on fire when you sit these multi-day retreats. You know, it's just like, you know, day in and day out, you really start to uncover and start to kind of get that, you get it, right? That affective feeling of what we might call faith or confidence of like, God, at least I found something that might work, right? And it's not this external thing. It's not a dogma. Even though there's all these elaborate Buddhist teachings, he's always referring it back to you. It's always about you, right? It's always about our direct experience. and this is many ways. So again, it's this radical self-confidence. It to me, I think it's actually an optimistic view. It's the Dharma offers us an optimistic frame on life that's honest. Yeah, there's tragedy and there's beauty. You know, the Buddha's willingness to be completely and totally honest about the human experience makes me trust him. Nothing is sugar-coated. Nothing. His uncompromising, just ongoing, uncompromising tendency to just give it to you straight. Sometimes it's overwhelming, you know? And also what's followed by that is like, and, you know, and there's something you can do about it, and I would not ask you to do that as if it was not possible. So we can get that bright sense of faith of like, oh, there's a lot of relief that comes from finding something. And its correlation, this isn't always actually articulated, so I'll try to do it now, is that actually faith is very much correlated and interwoven into the concept of wisdom, of understanding. And because there's this Dharma is good in the beginning, in the middle, and the end, and there's three elements of the faith kind of mechanism, there's also three ways in which wisdom is cultivated. And a lot of times this bright faith, it just comes, you know, there's an understanding of a theory or a concept, which is usually how many of us end up in the Buddhist space, you know. You read a book, you hear an interview, you hear a podcast, and all of a sudden you're like, well, gee, that kind of makes sense, actually. You know, what's being said, what's being offered here. There's a cognitive dimension to it. Like, we all struggle with a lot of these things. And, you know, JD and I bond over this constantly, and I'm sure many of you do as well. One of the things that made Dharma practice a little bit easier for me was not just the relief that I got from it, but I was being offered a frame that actually seemed like it lined up. You know, I remember the first time I sat with Steve Smith, when I kind of told him about all the loss experience I've been through before I meditated, it was the first time in my life I ever felt like an adult was sitting down with me, telling me the truth about life. You know, he's like, yeah, suffering? Lots of it. Totally. You are correct. I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, because how many times do we have that? I'm the only one who's having this horrible experience. Everybody else on the retreat is. You look around, you're like, everybody's totally enjoying the retreat. Everybody is totally connected with their experience in a deep way, radiating loving kindness inward and outward in all directions. I just, I want to get in my car and go to Taos and get some tacos, man. This sucks. Right? Well, we have those. It's like, you know, it's like everybody can't be the odd man out. You know? But we do. We get this feeling. And then when we get offered this kind of way of practicing, and one thing why I think it's like, maybe I harp on it a little bit, and these two do as well, which is why I like teaching with them, is that we want to really do the work of offering you a frame that kind of makes sense, even though we don't know a lot of you, because I notice that when I'm offered some kind of framing or understanding of a practice that makes sense, I'm going to actually practice it or approach it with a great deal of sincerity. Like, if there's trust, if I trust my teachers, if I trust what's being offered, I'm actually going to really, really practice with some diligence and some sincerity. If I'm suspicious and not really sure, I might not even practice at all. So this is why there's so much emphasis on this Pali word, ahipasako. Come and see for yourself. Come and have a look, young man. That's what I was told. Don't take my word for it. And I was like, yeah, suffering, yeah, totally. Check. That adds up. You know, and it's like, and then there's this tremendous way of like, well, there's actually things that you can do. You know, there's practices. It's not the end of the story, thank God. It's the beginning of the story. And then we overcome these little challenges. Sometimes it's just like, wow, I made it till the bell rang. It's like, woohoo. You know, that's how it was for me at the beginning. You know, it's like, you know, these little dharmic successes, they're not that impressive at the early stages, right? That's okay. But we do, we get that sense of faith being bright. We're offered ideas that make sense. We practice a little bit and we start to see. In a clinical context, the word that they use that's actually really valuable in the therapeutic world is self-efficacy. That's just a fancy way to say come and see for yourself. It's like, okay, I know this to be true. And that's really the kind of affective faith. I know this to be true because I just know this to be true. I cannot be convinced otherwise. You see what I mean? You see how it's inside out? It's actually, we do need to believe in. We need to believe in. Right? And that's really what we're doing here. We're trying to really believe in that we have this really capacity to face everything. And people do it all the time. There's so many great stories. You know, I heard like six of them earlier today. Everybody here probably has a story very similar to the one that I'm pointing to. And where you are in that story, where you are in that journey is irrelevant. It's good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, it's good in the end. And so again, also just to say, like, this bright faith, it's not blind faith. You know, it's experiential. We experience these things. You know, it's like there's a, it's like the good story between the concept and the experience. There's a story Ajahn Sumedho talks about, which I like to use the story because I'm from New England and I love New England maple syrup. All the other syrup that you get in other parts of the country, even if it says New England maple syrup, is not New England maple syrup. It's the best. And it's like the analogy, see, someone's talking, it's like you're trying to explain to somebody what maple syrup tastes like. And they're like, well, is it like honey? You're like, yeah, kinda, not really. Well, is it like molasses? Yeah, a little bit, but no, it's actually not like that either. And we can go back and forth on and on and on, but what do I need to do? I need to take a spoonful of delicious New England maple syrup and stick it in your mouth. And then you know immediately. And that's why we use the word and we place so much emphasis on this word contact, paso, to touch, to be touched, right? To really just to have that kind of taste, you know, like the Buddha says, the Dharma has one, just like the ocean has one taste, the taste of salt. The Dharma has only one taste, the taste of freedom. It's its only flavor. And we get many, many, many experience of that, right? It can be subtle. It can be very, very subtle. It can be so subtle we don't even notice it. It can also be truly and totally profound, right? And you get a range of those while you're here, you know? It can just be that sense of, I might be okay. Or that expense, I've heard people talk about group, you're just walking out here and you, the suchness of the property is just so alive, you're just like, I can't even take it. You know, you want to like take a picture of it or like you want to, again, you can't appreciate it because you want to, I just want to get a little bit of some of this, right? And so we really want to learn how to work with this concept of faith as a practice because it's so supportive, so supportive. And it's not blind. You know, we test it. And this is where that second element of faith that Sharon talks about as verified faith. And when you go through the process of wisdom, when you get into kind of the middle of practice, it's good in the middle, because in the middle it's like, you know, we've been doing it for a little bit of while. We've been sitting for a couple of years. We've done a couple of these multi-day retreats. You know, we're maybe taking the Dharma into other areas of our life. It's going to work on us. It's going to work on us. Right? And we start to see we get that kind of verified faith. Where we test the teachings through our own direct experience. It's that second dimension of the wisdom dimension of mind that's maybe the hardest and the most important, which is the application, right? Which is the practice, you know, which is like taking it. And this is where I think most religions fall short, is they just dwell. They're just books on the shelves. You know what I mean? They're just concepts. They're just dogmas. There's no embodiment. There's no application. There's no contemplative component. And this is where the Buddha is very staunch about the mind, is that he says a lot of things about the mind, but his primary thing he says about the mind is you are going to have to train it. You know? It'd be nice to just read like one Dharma book and be like, cool. I'm going to do that from now on. Right. So it's like, again, part of the process of having some humility is like Dharma practice comes with tremendous, tremendous failure. You know? Like even just sitting in 20 minutes, how many times do you fail? Like 67 times? You know, it's just like, that's the whole practice. And so it is this application of like bringing it back, trying to cultivate these qualities, right? And you see it. I'm sure that you all see, having done it for multiple days, there is a result to that. Something happens. But nothing happens if you don't do it. This is the uncompromising part of it. It's like wisdom is not knowledge, because knowledge is knowing something. Knowledge is knowing that. Wisdom is knowing how. For example, I know and I totally believe that things are constantly changing. Do you agree? Is impermanence real? Well, when you're encountering real change and real loss in your life, does knowing that things change help you navigate that? Probably not so much, or maybe not even at all. You know? Like your car breaks down and you're like, oh, wow, impermanence. Like, the car no longer starts. Isn't that something? Right? You lose your job. You know, we're always talking about impermanence, but having a conceptual understanding of impermanence is like really not that impressive. It's like what happens when the rubber hits the road, as they say, right? You know, do we know how to adapt, to adjust? Are we practiced? Is the mind able to be fluid and to be adaptive and be able to say, okay, like, well, this is going to be a problem, and now I need to like, I need to conform with the new reality, like life on life's terms. Life is always doing this to me, you know? And how long does it take us to like, you know, in an emotional intelligence sense, how long does it take us to recover from a perceived setback? I like to take my time, you know? And then eventually you get on board, like after hours or days or weeks or months or years or never, you know? It's like so hard. And this is like core dharma. We also know and we maybe understand, and I certainly know and believe, that compassion is the appropriate response to the pain that I might be in at any given time. But when I'm in real, actual pain, compassion is not the first item in my drop-down menu. You know what I mean? I usually have to go through a bunch of other things. Sometimes it doesn't even arise, right? And a lot of times that's a result of, well, I haven't been practicing it. I don't have access to it. I haven't been cultivating it. You know? And so, like, one thing to just say, like, in the research around meditation, in the book, there's a really great book if you want to, like, really get the skinny on meditation research, a book by Dan Goleman and Richard Davidson called Altered Traits, where they really, and those guys are advocates of mindfulness, and they kind of interrogate some of the hype. And one of the things is that actually sitting these multi-day silent retreats is like really, really getting, you're leaving here like on 110%. Actually much more so than like just sitting daily. Daily practice is certainly good, but they say that like being in this kind of container, in this kind of environment, I mean, just for your like brain and nervous system alone, forget about your feelings and your emotions and all your stuff, all your subjective stuff. Your nervous system and your body and your brain are very happy with you right now. Right? It's just so good for us. Because you've been cultivating, I mean, I bet you hundreds of thousands of moments. Probably in the millions if we added them all up in the last 7 days. Most people will live their whole lives and never even get a sense or an opportunity to do this. So again, like I talked about with the appreciation, it's like anything that you can do to not take it for granted, so invaluable. And so then we kind of come to the end of this, what Sharon calls abiding faith. There's that word again. We come to dwell. We come to abide. We just, this stabilizing, clarifying quality of mind just starts to be something that's just present a lot of the time. Right? And then the wisdom dimension of that is, again, it's taking the concept, the idea, it's applying it. And the third one, which I love, is this word fruition. You know, it's the eating of the fruit. It's the tasting of the freedom. It's like, yes, I know that this works. And as we look at it from an agricultural sense, as our life and our practice unfolds, we're always going through these. Sometimes we're just getting those seeds. Sometimes we're just getting introduced to a new idea that we just, I don't know, this doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand this. I'm not so sure about this. But then to be willing to, we'll try it on anyway. One of the things that I've noticed, just to give you, you might notice this in yourself, this was bad news for me. But I noticed and I learned over the years that whatever practice I was most aversive to was the one that I needed the most. I'm like, I don't know about this meta thing. Like, mindful, you know what I mean? So, like, if you get into whether it's compassion or forgiveness or, you know, it's like, I'm sure you have the one that you're like, eh. Chances are, just saying, there's evidence to suggest that that might be the one you need to take a look at. As my friend Chris McKenna likes to point out to me constantly, he's like, Dave, whatever you think it's not, that's probably what it is. I hate that. I'm like, no. I'm like, I remember being in trauma therapy. I'm like, I'm good with that. Like, I've made peace with that. It's like, oh, yeah, really? You know? That spiritual bypass. I'm like, no, I've totally worked through all of that. Wink, wink. You know? And so again, we have to be careful that we don't trick ourselves, and we have to be willing to kind of explore a lot of these ideas and a lot of these teachings. And as somebody who has a lot of suspicion and distrust towards things, that when I am introduced to a concept or an idea that sort of maybe doesn't make sense, I'm like pretty quick to dismiss it, which I can tell you is a very bad habit. For me, it has been. And there was a teacher at Berry Center for Buddhist Studies for a long time who's really one of the world's respected Buddhist scholars, named Andrew Olinsky. He's around. He offers classes. He's unbelievable. And I was doing a course with him one time, and I was kind of having a conversation with him about this. He said, well, what I suggest is, like, any time you get introduced to a teaching or to a concept that you're suspicious of or doesn't make sense, just say to yourself, I don't understand this yet. I just don't understand this yet. It's okay. Without dismissing it, trying to maintain some degree of agnosticism around it. Like, yeah, it doesn't really seem like it adds up, but, you know, it's trying to be open to these things, right? Because again, that and what that, for me, that's just that aversion. Like, not doing that. Before, I don't even, you know, they talk about it in the big book, like contempt prior to investigation. I don't even really know what's being offered, but I'm already like, yeah, no. Yeah, not that. And what's next on the menu? Right. And so we can really kind of sell ourselves short by giving into these areas where we might feel doubt or suspicion, and just not being, again, perhaps open-minded to them in a way. And then we have these periods of time where it's really much like it's the planting season. Where we're working with these concepts, we're trying things, we're not really sure, but we're giving it a shot anyway. And a lot of the meditation exercises that we offer you here, that you do, and we'll talk more about this, you know, as we leave, is like really just trying to dedicate yourself to having a practice that's regular. Because that, again, that's that middle stage of wisdom. That's that application process. That's that part of, you know, being out in the field in the hot sun, irrigating the earth, you know, planting, doing the hard work of cultivation. If anybody here has a garden, gardening is like really hard. You know, like we moved to Colorado many years ago. We have gardens, and I was totally humbled by how hard it was. I'm like, the blueberries at the grocery store are like $4. Like, you know, like, forget it, you know? You know, it's like, you know, we have peach trees, and it's like, you know, it's like to go from a peach seed, it's like 7 years maybe before you get the peach fruit. And you're like, but they're like, you know, they're like $2 down at the store, you know? But if you've ever eaten a peach off of a tree, they're much better, right? And so there's that understanding of that, like, really, the cultivation is the word that gets used. Well, that's actually the Pali word for meditation, is that we try to cultivate these qualities. And sorry to say, they take a while. You know, they do. But when we get those, really what we get, as I think, is we get glimpses of faith. We get glimpses of trust. we get glimpses of, like, hey, I think this is, like, this is doing something to me. This is actually working. And without that, you would totally abandon the entire project. You probably don't even know how much faith you actually have, because we, a lot of times, we don't necessarily investigate it in this way. And for me, it was very, very important to have, having done that. It's just like, oh my God, like, I have a lot of faith. You know, I have a lot of confidence, a lot of trust, a lot of whatever. And like I said, like, as you sit here and hear this, it's like, I had to do a lot of work personally to really work through this concept and the idea, because for me, it came with a whole boatload of baggage. And probably half the baggage was mine. Yeah. And so really, and then getting to a point where, like, oh no, this is actually really a fundamental aspect of the practice, right? It's this ability to have this refuge. And what happens over time is that we have this abiding faith, and this is where it really becomes a sense of empowerment, because there's a word, I forget the Pali word, but there's a thing that the Buddha talks about, when you get to this kind of dharma is good in the end, and there's a sense of abiding faith, and you've been doing this for some time, and there's been a lot of fruition, he says you become independent of others in the teaching. Right? Independent of others in the teaching. I love this idea, right? Where it's like, and even the Buddha says, may no two of you follow the same path. Right? And that's a very, very sense of an empowering idea, that I'm independent of others. And as we work with these traditions, one of the things that's been important to me, it's like, as much as I value and I respect the Insight tradition and all of the teachers that I've had and all of the teachings in the Theravada tradition, and some of which I still struggle with, some of which I may always struggle with, is like this kind of getting in this position of, how do I maintain a sense of being rooted in a tradition without being stuck in it? You know, how can I be rooted and have a sense of respect and a sense of reverence for where this comes from, but at the same time, be able to have my own sense of autonomy? And I think over time, we kind of get that sense of autonomy. We get that sense of understanding, this kind of abiding faith, this sense of refuge. And we oftentimes talk about taking refuge, which is a beautiful concept. But I think when we get into this abiding faith, and this is like really where I'll encourage you to reflect on this as you go back to the world, is not only can we take it, but we can become refuge for other people. You know, you just don't know if you're going to be the object or the person of somebody else's bright faith. You know, you're going to be talking to somebody about your time on retreat or your experience, and somebody else that you encounter in the world who's maybe still asleep and caught up in all of the suffering and the anguish of the world, and they meet you and you offer this, you become that Dharma door for somebody else, right? And this has been going on for, like, clearly a, like, long-ass time. Like, I've had Dharma doors, JD's had Dharma doors, Chris has had Dharma doors, we've all had them. And we've all gone through this experience. And it's really kind of beautiful to understand that you actually, whether this is your 500th retreat or your 50th retreat or your first retreat, you all have the potential to be that Dharma door for somebody else, to have that wisdom, to have enough of faith and confidence to be able to say, yeah, like, this is, like, you might want to try this. You might want to read this book. You might want to listen to this talk. You might want to check this out. You might not be as messed up as you think you are. Right? And this is like this, you know, I call it like Johnny Appleseed Dharma. It's like everybody like spreads off the property in a couple of days, and we're all these like seeds going out into the culture, you know, and having this potential and this opportunity to turn people on and to become that. And you don't have to be, you know, it's good in the beginning. And this is really kind of well articulated in the recovery world. It's like in AA and in recovery circles, it's like the guy who's been sober for 5 days can help the guy who's been sober for no days, right? Because he's got 5 days of experience that he can share. And probably the guy with 5 days is the much better person than the guy with 5 years. Because people will be like, how did you get 5 days, man? That's like... I remember when I was first getting sober and people would get like coins, you know. Someone would get 25 years, I'd be like, whatever. And then somebody would get like 30 days and I'd be like, 30 days? How the hell did you get 30 days? So a lot of times, you're the better Dharmador than we are, right? And we have this ability to really see that there is this timeless dimension to this practice. You know, it's good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, it's good in the end. And we can see, hopefully, that there's this really dynamic relationship between faith and wisdom. And that when there's faith, we practice with more diligence. We apply with more effort and more sincerity. And what the outcome of that is, we get this fruition moment. We get to eat the peach. And we have that fruition moment of wisdom, which what does that do? That gives us more faith. And that wisdom gives us more faith. And then we apply more. And we practice with more sincerity. And we make hard changes in our life. And we get that fruition moment. And that gives us wisdom. And that wisdom gives us more faith. And on and on and on it goes. And what we do is we kind of, this is the five spiritual faculties from faith to wisdom. On and on it goes. And we just start developing this kind of positive feedback loop in our lives, which is rooted in faith, which is manifested in wisdom. And it just allows the whole wheel of the Dharma to continue to roll on. And so without this concept of faith, without this as a kind of experiential practice, it's going to maybe go a little slower than you want it to. And I think that for probably obvious reasons, the tradition as it's been kind of going on for the last 50 years is, you know, we don't talk about faith so much, I think, because people are maybe a bit nervous or there's a lot of baggage with it. But you can have faith that the dinner bell will ring at 5:30. And here we go. So thank you very much for your kind attention. Please enjoy your food. And we'll see you back here this evening for some Brahma-Vihara practice. I didn't even have to look at the clock. God.